And a very good afternoon to your good self. How are you? It's Wednesday, so it is the 26th. Is it? It is the 26th of May, 2021. It is me, the BBG. Got a terrific programme for you. John Waters, Tony Gosling joining me, two terrific journalists. So without further ado, let's get on with it then.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, the terrific Irish journalist and author John Waters will be with me in hour two. Before that, Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk, the politics show, former BBC journalist, all-round good guy. And, well, we're just going to cover pretty much everything that we can between now and 7 o'clock. It's a big day for Salford Reds like myself. Salford's excited. Manchester United playing in the Europa League final in Gdansk later on in Poland. I've got the Rioja in. The Rioja is in. It isn't chilling because you don't chill red wine. At least I don't, anyway. It isn't chilling, but it is decanting. Can't wait for a sup. And hopefully we'll get a decent result, but you never know. You just never know in foosball. You can't predict these things. Let me go. Do you know what happened to me there just before coming on air? I hadn't loaded my audio because I was listening to Elton John singing the 12-inch version of Are You Ready for Love? And I forgot to load my audio, but I've done it in the nick of time. The media is focused this afternoon. It's been focused since 9:30 this morning on Dominic Cummings, the former chief advisor to Boris Johnson, the number one aide at number 10, has been, well, giving testimony in the Commons, answering questions about his time working in Downing Street during the pandemic. That's what's been going on. And everybody seemingly is watching this and they're all getting very excited about it. What did Cummings say so far today? Because to the best of my knowledge, he's still giving evidence, he's still answering questions. Well, he said that thousands of people died needlessly as a result of government mistakes. Thousands died needlessly, he said. He said Boris Johnson had initially dismissed coronavirus as a scare story. Bojo said it was a scare story, and apparently, with a lot of derring do and bravado, he offered to be injected with coronavirus to steady the nerves of the nation and to prove that it's not that big a deal at all. Right, that didn't happen, as we know. What else did Cummings say? The UK had been too slow to lock down. He said that Matt Hancock... Where do I start? Where does anybody start? He didn't have anything nice to say about the health secretary, a guy called Matt Hancock. Picture him. You know Matt Hancock, don't you? Yes, you do. What did Cummings say about him? Well, he said on multiple occasions today that Matt Hancock is a liar and that he was stupid and that he should have been fired. Now, we'll give Cummings that one. Old Hancock is useless, isn't he, Pat?
You have got me there. As useless as tits on a boar.
He's as useless as tits on a boar. Now, Cummings went on to say today that he would like to say to all the families of those who died unnecessarily how sorry he is for the mistakes that were made and for his own mistakes as well. Johnson, the Prime Minister, hit back at Prime Minister's question, saying the government's priority has always been to save lives. So Cummings was forced out of number 10 at the end of last year. He said it was crackers, that Johnson and Matt Hancock were in charge, claiming thousands of people could have provided better leadership than the PM or Labour leader at the time, Jezza Corbyn. He said the management of government officials and those on the so-called front line was akin to lions being led by donkeys. The good old nurses and doctors on the front line fighting the virus face to face are the lions and the donkeys. Well, Cummings says, the government. The government was not on a war footing, he said in February 2020. The PM was skiing, literally skiing. He went on to say that, as I've already said, Johnson said, let's get Chris Whitty to inject me live on TV with the virus to show that there's nothing to fear. One of the interesting things Cummings said today was about care home deaths and how those might have been avoided. And he talks about Matt Hancock here. This is certainly worth hearing, particularly if you know anybody who sadly passed away in a care home in spring of last year or late winter. Here's Cummings.
He came back after being ill. What on earth has happened with all of these people in care homes? Hancock told us in the cabinet room that people were going to be tested before they went back to care homes. What the hell happened?
So he actually said in cabinet that...
In the cabinet room.
Oh, sorry. Not in cabinet. So put directly to the Prime Minister.
Yes. We were told categorically in March that people will be tested before they went back to care homes. We only subsequently found out that that hadn't happened. Now, all the government rhetoric was, we put a shield around care homes and blah, blah, blah. It was complete nonsense. Quite the opposite of putting a shield around them. We sent people with COVID back to the care homes.
Thank you.
So, Hancock said that people would be tested before being sent into care homes. They weren't in cells and died. Anything to say to Hancock, Gene?
You stupid, ignorant son of a bitch, dumb bastard! Jesus Christ, I've met some dumb bastards in my time, but you outdo them all!
Yes, except it isn't stupidity, is it? It's something else entirely. Sky News' Beth Rigby is a veteran. She's a hack. Political editor these days. What have we seen, Beth? Here's Beth Rigby summing up what we've seen today.
In terms of what we've had, what an extraordinary, astonishing set of evidence. And for me, what stands out is this: when Dominic Cummings was asked about when there would be a public inquiry, should it be brought forward, he said, in his view, tens of thousands of people died who didn't need to die. And really, in terms of all of this evidence, all the psychodrama around his relationship with Boris Johnson, around what he did or didn't say about that trip to Durham, it's about what decisions were made and what material impact did they have on people's lives and their families. And that consideration by him that tens of thousands of people died who didn't need to die, well, that is a very, very difficult question and statement for the government to answer. And whatever your view is, I would argue, about Dominic Cummings' credibility, he was in the room when these decisions were being taken. And today he is lifting the veil on some of the chaos that was going on and the lack of preparedness within government and the consequences of that on care homes. That really stood out, that he said it was nonsense that there was a ring of steel around care homes. People were being discharged to care homes having not been tested. He said the government fell disastrously short of standards the public have a right to accept. He says the government were asleep at the wheel during February and accepts his responsibility in that. And he said that in terms of the Prime Minister, that he went on holiday for 2 weeks in February and dismissed COVID as a scare story, likening it to the swine flu. Very critical there of the Prime Minister. He then goes on.
Yeah, I told you all that. We'll leave that there. What did the government say?
The government's view is that we should be looking forward, that they are dealing with the pandemic. But questions around that second lockdown, it was well documented. I wrote and spoke about it at the time, that the Prime Minister had been advised to kick in that circuit breaker at the end of October. He refused to do so, only to end up having to go into a lockdown later in November, and doing so reluctantly. And he is alleged to have said that he would rather see bodies piled high than ever go into a third lockdown. We, of course, did go into a third lockdown in January. He has publicly denied that Dominic Cummings will no doubt be asked about that at the committee today. But if you think about how uncomfortable that testimony was in terms of the first lockdown, January into March, what was happening, why wasn't the government prepared? You know, you heard what he said about Helen McNamara, the former Deputy Cabinet Secretary, saying that we are absolutely expletive. I can't use the word.
But yeah, fucked. Fucked is the word. We are absolutely fucked, she allegedly said. Look, John Pierce, I don't know John. He is someone who tweets me occasionally on Twitter. How you doing, John? I think John has nailed it. John Pierce, at Johnny Tidy. Get in there, Johnny Tidy. He's nailed it. Cummins sounds like another vaccine promotion. This is part of, this is a chapter of the overall psychological operation that is being run against you, me, and everyone else in the country. Cummings' appearance is all about telling people that lockdown, 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 lockdown harder, lockdown quicker, lockdowns work, lockdowns are good. That's what it's all about. I haven't grabbed the audio because I can't find it in the sequence. I wasn't near the studio when I heard it. But at one stage today, Cummings referenced Carl Hennigan and Sunetra Gupta from Oxford University. But he didn't refer to them by their proper titles or by their Christian names. Excuse me, Sunetra Gupta. I don't think Sunetra is a Christian. She might well be. She might well be. By their forenames. By their forenames. He talked very, 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 very briefly about the opposing science or views of opposing scientists. And he was very dismissive. He referenced Hennigan and Gupta. That's all he said. This today was a showcase for doubling down on the idea that lockdowns are very, very good and very, very important, and that we should never delay to impose a lockdown on the public. And also the vaccines. Yes, John is right. It was also a showcase for how fantastic vaccines are and how we should take them and how we can expect to be taking them forevermore. So it might be painted in the press as hell has no fury like a woman scorned, right? Cummings was turfed out of Downing Street last year. This is his revenge. That's how it will be sold by conservatives. They will sell it thus. The woke left will seize upon this because they hate Johnson. And they will use this to say callous Johnson and callous Hancock cost tens of thousands of lives because they didn't lock down quick enough and listen to the scientists. Today was a showcase for junk science, junk scientists, lockdowns and vaccines. That's how I saw it today anyway. There were no serious questions to Cummings about, well, maybe the lockdown itself wasn't a good idea. Cummings got an easy ride today. And I'll be talking to Tony Gosling about this in a couple of minutes' time. Your opinion may very well differ to mine. Please tweet me. I will read them out. Dissenting voices. BBG Richie. It's BBG Richie. That's how I see it myself, right? But it's just my opinion. He sat there today and talked about how everybody, you know, would have been far better off if we just locked down quicker and harder. Not just the first time, but before Christmas as well. There was no discussion today about the impact of lockdown on the economy. Not much discussion. And there was certainly no discussion about what about the other debts, the other impacts of lockdown. Forget viruses. What about the other impacts on people who can't get treatment for things they need treatment for and all the rest of it? Mental health, children, none of that. So basically it was a love-in for Sage. Sage is Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance, and 27 or 28 other goons, most of whom have connections to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, CEPI or Gavi. That's how I saw it, and I did hear quite a bit of it today. Please, as I said, share your opinions with me. I'd love to hear you. William says it's more and more theatre, promoting instant lockdowns and, of course, offering hopium. Chris says, I wonder if Benedict Cumberbatch would agree to play the total shill Cummings now. Yes, look, don't forget, Johnson is an idiot. He's a dangerous fool, Boris Johnson. He's a puppet, isn't he? Like every other leader in every other world country. Hancock is a goon. These guys take orders from other people and they implement them. Now, my great friend Jean Anne, who's always worth listening to because she's been around a long time, has written for the national press, is very open-minded. Very open-minded. Takes a much broader view of these things than many people do. And Jean Anne is wondering how much of Johnson's reluctance to lock down and to impose these draconian measures on society was actually genuine. Now, you might scoff at Jean Anne and say, no, Johnson is in on it. Johnson was in on it. But bear in mind, I've always believed, however dreadful Donald Trump is as a human being, and he is odious, he's horrible, Trump and anybody around him, horrible people. I believe that on the campaign trail, back in 2015, 2016, Trump believed the rubbish he was spouting. He believed he could end overseas intervention. He believed he could stop immigration that was impacting on working class people. He might even have believed that he could have sent crooked Hillary to jail. Then he's elected. And then he's told how it is. How you doing, Donald? Got a film to show you, mate. It's about 40 seconds long. Yes, let me give you a trigger warning. You're going to see somebody's head get blown off. So Donald is brought in. I suppose you've got to take the broader view sometimes of somebody like Jean Anne. Maybe Johnson and his eccentric father, even though both of them are committed depopulation madmen, aren't they? Maybe some of these so-called conservative principles, maybe he holds some of them dear. Maybe he was aghast at the idea of telling people to shut down their businesses. Maybe he was. But in the end, he couldn't do anything about it because Boris Johnson isn't and hasn't ever been running this country. Neither was Tony Blair. Neither was Theresa May. Neither was John Major. These are front men. Watch the film Casino. Watch it. I did a video on this. It's still on YouTube. It's an amazing thing. It's had millions of views. I drew an analogy between the global power structure and the movie Casino. Casino begins with a guy called Philip Green, who's a real estate guy. He's a nobody. And he's given a loan of $70 million to buy the Tangiers Hotel in Las Vegas so that it looks like Philip Green is running the Tangiers Casino. But he isn't. He's a front man for the mob. Boris Johnson is a front man for the mob. We can't lock down. It's against civil liberties. Yes, but you'll just do what you're told, Boris. And the beat goes on. Tony Gosling will be with me momentarily. We'll get his thoughts on that. Do not, by the way, forget that John Waters, who I'm very fond of, Irish journalist and author, will be with me as well. He'll be on in hour two. We're building up to the Europa League. I'm only joking. We're not. There'll be no more talk of foosball on the Richie Allen Radio Show, which is live from Salford, Super Salford, in the northwest of the UK. RichieAllen.co.uk is my website. Check it out. Yeah, the Pasadenas, and I'm doing fine now. 21 minutes past 5 o'clock. Tony Gosling momentarily. We'll wait for him to walk into the room before introducing him. Patricia says, it is also likely Bill Gates is a front man for the mob, as was Epstein. Mere money runners for the hidden hand. This is an excellent point. If you saw the film Casino, think of it. Philip Green, who's played by a great Jewish actor, whose name escapes me. He was also in A Few Good Men. He played Sam Weinberg in A Few Good Men. And he plays Philip Green in Casino. So he's the guy then that to the public, it looks like he was given a loan from the Teamsters to buy the casino. Then we see Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro is going to be managing the casino. He's above Philip Green. Everybody thinks Philip Green is the boss, but he isn't. He's a nobody. Robert De Niro is Bill Gates, or Bill Gates is represented in the casino scenario by Bill Gates. Bill Gates isn't the boss. I mentioned this on the program last night. He's another capo regime for the mob. The real bosses, I believe in my heart of hearts, nobody, either on this programme, who's ever been on this programme, by the way, that includes Jim Mars and David Icke, nobody knows these people's names. These people are so hidden, they are almost completely unknown. The ones that call the shots. What David Icke has done over the years, which I find to be brilliant, is the spider's web, where you have the central control system in the middle, you have the ultimate hidden hand, and then you spread out then across the web to everything that we see, the banks, the financial institutions, the IMF, down to the think tanks, which give policies, which instruct governments and political parties what their policies should be. Governments don't come up with policies. You can't believe for a minute that a government of any era actually comes up with the policies that it takes to the House of Commons to be voted upon and then to be basically put into law. They don't. They get their ideas from think tanks. Where do the think tanks come from and who informs them? Anyway, loads to get through with Tony. Don't have to tell you anything about Tony Gosling you don't already know. Brilliant journalist, brilliant writer, great guy. The Politics Show host, co-host, Tony likes to say. We are going to talk about Martin Bashir. We are going to talk about Belarus and what's going on there. We might talk a bit about Palestine. But we're going to kick off, of course, with Cummings. Let's welcome back to the programme, live from Bristol, my great friend Tony Gosling. That was a terrific speech you gave at that protest a couple of weeks back, Tony. Well done, my friend. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's very kind of you. But, you know, my main problem is that so much of what we're dealing with today is the treachery of the mass media. Most of what we're being told, it's very much like, you know, when I was a kid, we were told stories of Soviet Russia. That the population had to have a kind of decoder inside their heads. It's very 1984, you know, where we've got to kind of figure out what the truth is and read between the lines the whole time, because people who are paid to share key, important life-saving information with us have just sold out to the pharmaceutical industry because they know, I think, you know, it's basically dog whistle stuff, that they know that if they start telling the truth, that they'll be out of their job in 5 minutes because the pharmaceutical lobby and the globalist lobby, and let me say also the Bilderberg lobby, because it's the Bilderberg social media that have been censoring the doctors as well as the mass media. You know, they've just been taking people like Tess Laurie, you know, in Bath from the evidence-based medicine consultancy she runs off the internet again and again and again. And she is a qualified doctor. That she was saying that she delivered thousands of babies when over in, but apparently we're not allowed to hear her opinion.
No, we're not. She has to come on a programme like this to be heard in this country. She has to speak to somebody like you to be heard in this country. That's a wonderful thing because you're a brilliant journalist. But as good as you are, and as much of a reach as you have and I have, it's nothing compared to the BBC or Sky News. So we bring her on and we talk to her and we challenge her and we let her speak. But, you know, it's nothing like if she goes on BBC Breakfast. It's treachery. Can I just say this before you go on? I was watching Sky News this morning at 6:10. There's a very young presenter on there now in the morning. Her name is Vanessa. And she's a charming woman, she is. She, you know, she's well presented and she can present. And she introduced the story today about strokes and AstraZeneca. This is how bad the media has become, Tony. She said to, she talked about the strokes in three people, and then she introduced some professor. It doesn't matter. It's one of the usual mob. Her first question to him was, "Welcome, professor," she said. "Now, it's important that we, mind, reassure people that this is very, very rare, isn't it?" Tony, that's fucking garbage. That's garbage. That's testifying. You're the journalist. It's up to you to ask him to prove that it's an anomaly and that it's rare. She said it's rare, isn't it? I mean, in your time in the BBC, you'd have been fired for that.
Well, I don't know if I'd have been fired for it. I'd certainly have had my knuckles wrapped when we came off air by my producer or my editor. Yeah. And, you know, actually what it is, it's collusion. So what you're doing is you're having somebody on who's been conning the public now for months and months. And what you're doing is you're just going along with it. You're not asking them any awkward questions.
No.
And this is the problem, is that the difficult questions aren't, it's not just they're not answered, because of course these people are quite good at manoeuvring around questions. They're not even asked. And what we're getting is we're getting kids straight out of their O-level, you know, media studies or whatever, put onto national radio and television, whilst all the seasoned journalists around the country have slowly been, you know, squeezed off the airwaves.
Kicked out.
You know, so it is. It's treachery. And it's all in the aim of getting more and more and more of these vaccines out there and effectively, you know, bamboozling the public into thinking, well, everyone must be doing it. I'm just getting opinions saying it's great. You know, we have almost, listening on talk radio yesterday, they've got adverts on there, which have got this kind of, you know, almost like sunshine music in the background. Oh, you know, have your vaccine.
Yeah.
It's going to be really lovely and wonderful. You know, this is a hard sell. And the reason I figured this out 2 weeks ago, Richie, I interviewed Dr. Stanley Laham from Florida University, who I've had on a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is he's a pro-Palestinian doctor, retired immunologist, spent his whole life in immunology. And he explained to me, he took me through the last 10 years of the results of the flu vaccine, right? Nothing to do with COVID. This is just looking at the flu vaccine. And he explained that in 2018, it became absolutely clear from the statistics that the flu vaccine was not doing anything at all.
Nothing.
Despite the billions of pounds being spent on it to stop the flu. Nothing at all. And possibly even the opposite. You know, so it became absolutely clear statistically in 2018, the flu vaccine was a total failure. Now, in order to, what he was suggesting was, in order to obscure this fact, in other words, to stop the withdrawing of any public funding for flu vaccine, this is partly one of the reasons why there's been this massive push for the COVID vaccine. It's because the pharmaceutical industry know the flu vaccine has failed. It's about to be possibly withdrawn forever from the market for having failed. And so they need to, first of all, obscure that fact. And then secondly, double down by having another vaccine, which is possibly going to fail, in order to just keep their industry going. It's a bit like the nuclear industry. When we saw Fukushima and all the results of that, the money that's been piled into the nuclear industry, it became clear that the nuclear industry was a total disaster. So what did we do in this country? Oh, well, we introduced a whole new program of building new nuclear power stations, like Hinkley Point, just down the road in the North Somerset coast here. So these massive industries have got a momentum of cash, and they spend billions on keeping that industry going, however much of failure it is. And exactly the same, I think, is true for the nuclear and the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to vaccines.
No doubt about it. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk, live from Bristol. I watched an awful lot of Dominic Cummings today, and Mike, this is what I've deduced. I'll give it to you in 30 seconds, and then you can take over. It's being painted, of course, by the media that this is revenge, that this is hell has no fury, like a senior advisor scorned. It's him getting his own back, having left Downing Street or being kicked out late last year. I see it completely differently. I see this as another brick in this big PSYOP wall. Cummings is selling. It's a hard sell today for lockdowns, for quick lockdowns, for longer lockdowns, for harder lockdowns, and for vaccines. That's what I see it as. But the media will present it as some sort of, you know, Dallas soap opera type JR against Bobby Ewing kind of a thing, when in reality this is carefully orchestrated. It's mind control over the public. The lockdowns are good. We should do them really early, really hard. Take your vaccines. That's how I see it. How do you see it, Tony?
Well, I mean, this time last year, we had 3 weeks of an attempt to get Dominic Cummings sacked by trial by media. Everything he said was a lie, a lie, a lie. The guy's a liar, a liar, a liar. This week, guess what? He's not a liar anymore.
That's right.
He tells the truth. He's a whistleblower. He's a, you know, what? I mean, if put myself in his shoes, I think what's happening here is that he's been instructed by the deep state. Look, if you want to have any career in the future, if you want to actually go on to greater things, which we might even get a knighthood after this, you never know, is you toe the line on X, Y, and Z, and, you know, then everyone will pat you on the back again. The idea that this guy is just, you know, there to just blow the whistle on what's been going on. As far as I know, this inquiry, right, it should have started on the big issues to do with the pandemic. Number one, the massive amounts of money that went into the totally failed models from Johns Hopkins University and Imperial College, from the Gates Foundation, the massive amount of money that's gone into the revolving doors between the Wellcome Foundation and SAGE, people like Jeremy Farrar on SAGE, the total ignoring of these life-saving cures, which Tess estimates killed 60,000 people in the UK for not being introduced early on, the ivermectin particularly, which was being, you know, some doctors were saying this straight away, but nobody was listening. And more doctors have come on board with this, you know, looking at all the figures and the scant studies that have been done, because, of course, the pharmaceutical industry funds almost all the medical studies, and it doesn't want to fund ivermectin because it's not going to make any money out of it. So, I mean, this is the sort of thing I would have expected to be number one on the list in any kind of honest public inquiry done into this pandemic, is to let's have a look at the things we know have killed people, tens of thousands of people, not to have some sort of little cameo for the superstar Dominic Cummings, who magically, over a year, has turned from a serial liar into a superhero.
And nobody wanted to ask Cummings today, where was your conscience last June or July or August or September? Why didn't you blow the whistle then? You're apologising today for needless excess deaths. Why didn't you blow the whistle sooner? It's so stage managed, it's almost untrue. Tony Gosling is our guest. Let's leave it alone for a moment, Tony. And let's talk about another story, which, fair play to you, I've been following, well, I do follow you on Twitter, but your tweets on the Martin Bashir saga are very incisive, I think. And this is a very important story because of where this might lead in terms of censorship. Now, Martin Bashir might very well have I've told a couple of porky pies to get an interview with Princess Diana. He might have falsified a document. It's not good.
Well, I don't think he did.
Do you not? Well, just before you come in on that, just before you...
I'll listen to you, but I don't think that was what got him the interview.
I'm not saying he did. I'm not saying he did. I'm saying he might have. I'm saying he might have. The point I was going to make is, whether he did or whether he didn't, it's apparent to me, I've read Morton's book. I read it years ago. I had Noel Bossom on my radio show. Rest in peace, Noel Bossom, for many years. I've known people who've been around the Diana story for years. It's apparent to me that Princess Diana was telling the truth to Martin Bashir, or what she believed to be the truth. So regardless of how Bashir ended up sitting in front of her, surrounded by cameras and sound men, the fact is she was telling the truth. And there seems to be a big movement against that, and that's something you're very concerned about, T.
Well, look, I think this is a reaction to a documentary that went out on ITV last year called The Revenge of a Princess.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant 2-hour-long documentary on ITV, which looked at that documentary, whatever it is, I suppose, well, 25 years on, the panorama film, and how it was made. And it was absolutely, in fact, I think there's only one of the parts of the two parts available anymore on YouTube or anywhere else I can find. But it was absolutely devastating. It was a look at how the princess most definitely did want to do the interview. She came willingly into Panorama. It wasn't any sort of con job by Martin Bashir. And who is Martin Bashir now? Well, he was the religious broadcasting chief at the BBC.
Until recently.
Means, for example, He was in charge until last week of things like Radio 3's choral Evensong, you know, things like that, which we wouldn't get anywhere if we didn't get from the BBC and Radio 3. You know, he was a very influential guy, the Daily Service, things like that that they do on the BBC. Martin Bashir is in charge, and that he's been booted out now. But the amazing thing that happened over the weekend was this, you know, removal of Hall as well, who'd been Director General at the time. Tony Hall. Now, he was nothing to do with the BBC anymore. He was the director of the National Gallery. But it just so happens that Prince Charles is the patron of the National Gallery. So Charles is doing whatever he can to, I think, I would say it's a 25-year-old vendetta against anybody that supported his ex-wife, who, by the way, I believe absolutely 100% was murdered, assassinated in Paris. No doubt in my mind whatsoever about that, because there were various reasons for that, which we could go into if you want. But this, I think, that's going on now is a long-term vendetta that Charles has to get anybody who was involved in that. Because the BBC at the time was far, far, far more professional and ballsy than it is now. It's now supine. Back then, they were prepared to dish the dirt on Charles, because that's what it really meant, that doing that interview.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
The dirt,
yeah,
on Prince Charles. Of course, she has got no ability now to speak, you know, Diana, to give her side of this. And it seems that there's hardly anyone apart from Esther Ranson who came out at the weekend on the Mar show to give any kind of balance in this argument, because everyone is scared to death of having the royal family, you know, jump down their throats over this, Richie.
I'll tell you what was interesting, T. I'll tell you what was interesting about what's happened in recent weeks and the reaction of the media. And you talked there about the BBC, and I was going to jump on you and criticise you and argue with you about the BBC being better back then. I was going to argue with you. But when I think back...
Oh, it was.
I was just going to say, when I think back, only 18 months afterwards, the BBC ran a programme asking, had she been murdered? And to its credit, it managed not to editorialise and left the programme open-ended. I can't imagine that happening in 2021. So I think back then it certainly was. Landmines for me, Noel Botham, I've interviewed Noel, God love him. I interviewed everybody around that, even some of the reporters who were in Paris at the time. And many people settled on this landmine thing, her persuading Bill Clinton to publicly say that he would support the outlawing of landmines. Then you have Keith Allen and others who came on programmes with me. You know these people as well. You've interviewed them. And they believe that the Duke of Edinburgh had some part in the murder of Princess Diana. It's we're never going to know now, are we, really? We can only guess.
I think we do know. And the way you find out, and the books to read are written by John Morgan. There's two main ones. I would say the short one is The Paris-London Connection, which is a very easy read, and it takes you through the main points. But then there's another one called How They Murdered Princess Diana by John Morgan, who is sadly no longer with us, the Australian investigative journalist. He explains everything. Really, you know, what he's done is he's gone through the three main bits of public evidence. There were, in fact, the police reports weren't public, but he got leaked copies of them from both Paris and France and London, the Scotland Yard one, and the Paget report, and also the transcripts of the inquest. So he had all of that stuff together. He put together the whole business, really, from start to finish. So basically what happened, there were people on high-powered motorbikes. Now, he's not entirely sure who they were. They could be French special forces, Israeli special forces, or even SAS, on powerful motorbikes that were intimidating the car. The car tried to go faster than they were going, but obviously the motorbikes were faster. And then there was some sort of trigger mechanism on the front part of the car, which made it suddenly swerve one side and straight into a pillar. Now, Diana survived the crash. She was actually reasonably healthy. She'd scored, I think it's 13 out of 14 on the trauma scale. So there was no urgency to treat her, but she was put into an ambulance, taken to Saltpeter Hospital, and then she was effectively murdered by the people in the ambulance on the way. So that's what he has put together from all that evidence.
But he can't prove that, though. This is the problem.
Sorry?
He can't prove that. He suspects it, and he's got enough circumstantial evidence to lead him to report on it, but he can't prove it. That's the thing. I've heard similar stories. Noel said to me, again, God rest him, years ago, he felt that she was given... Somebody put a hand over her mouth and nostrils in the car and killed her there and then. That's what he said.
Well, she was operated on.
She was operated on in some way,
or injected with something in the ambulance. Yeah. Anyway, the point being, why? You mentioned quite correctly landmines. The other reason was she was about to announce her engagement to Dodi Fayed. Now, the idea of William and Harry having a Muslim, immediate Muslim stepfather, was totally out of the question as regards the royal family. They didn't want that to happen at all because of that Islamic influence there would immediately be on the royal family. So they were very, and that was, I think, the key thing. If you look at, I can't remember the guy's name. He used to work for do the Scallywag paper. He put out a thing at the time, which I've still got a copy of, actually, which showed that they'd already booked a room to do a press conference to announce the engagement in London were 2 or 3 days after she was killed. So this is why they didn't want her to announce that engagement.
Is there hard evidence that they had booked a press conference, her and Dodi? Is there hard evidence, T, that they booked a press conference?
It's a long time ago since I read it. I wish I could remember the name of the guy from Scallywag. He is no longer with us. But that was put out. It's now disappeared off the internet. You can't find it anywhere.
Can I ask you this, Steve? What about the theory? Can I ask you this? Let me ask you. No, this is important. This is important. Can I ask you this? There are those who say that there was no way in hell that she was going to announce her engagement, that she wouldn't do that to her children, that any relationship she might have carried on with Dodie, she would have done it reasonably privately or as privately as she possibly could. What do you say to that?
No chance, because she's a free spirit. She's not going to wreck her future on the rock of Prince Charles. No chance. And you know, she realised that he had a relationship with Camilla. He can go up and remarry her, and she's going to go and remarry somebody that loves her.
Yeah.
You know, that was the problem. She was in this loveless relationship. But back to the Bashir business. I mean, I've been absolutely disgusted to see the way that this has been so one-sidedly treated, and also even compared to the Savile scandal. Well, hang on a minute. Doing some really good investigative journalism, in other words, this amazing... In fact, this is one thing I want to tell you. Back in around about 98, I was invited up to a conference up at the Director General's suite in Broadcasting House. And I actually met a guy called Richard Eyre, who was the... this is, you know, just literally...
I think it'd be
98, some very, very shortly after that interview. And I think possibly around about the time that Diana died. And he explained to me, he said it was absolutely rivetingly exciting doing that, because we knew that we as the BBC were doing it in the public interest, giving Diana her voice, but we had to really tiptoe around the royal family, because we knew if they got a sniff at the fact that we were about to do this documentary, in other words, there was nothing in the Radio Times about it, it wasn't announced beforehand at all, they had to bring the camera crew into Kensington Palace to film it secretly. In fact, they even wrapped up all the camera equipment in used hi-fi boxes to disguise the fact of what it actually was when it went in, so that it wouldn't trigger a sort of security alert of some sort. And they got an absolute adrenaline rush, Richard Eyre and other people at the top of the BBC at the time, from doing it, because they knew this is what the BBC's here for, to do documentaries like this, and we're not going to allow the royal family, because the BBC is constituted under a royal charter, to shut this down. And also because the royal family did control the BBC via the chairman, Marmaduke Hussey, who was married to the Queen's chief lady-in-waiting. So they knew, if we're going to do this piece of public service broadcasting, we've got to make sure that the royal family don't get a whiff of it, because if they do, this documentary is never going to go to air. And so they did, I think, what is an absolutely brilliant bit of public service broadcasting in getting that out there.
Yeah, I agree. Looking back on it, looking at it with more experienced eyes, because I was a very, very young would-be broadcaster and producer back then. Looking at it now, yeah, they were absolutely right to go with it. Bashir didn't coerce her into saying anything. He didn't lead her in the interview. He was very inexperienced, but yet he didn't lead her, in any direction. She was pretty forthright with her views and what she wanted to say. So I totally endorse that, you know.
The other thing that's not come out, Richie, is that actually by forging these documents, these bank statements, he was going in the wrong direction. He was trying to get to her through her family, right? Thinking that her family was supporting her. Her family weren't. Most of her family were actually on the side of Charles and the royal family and the establishment. Not on her side at all.
Yeah.
So he was wasting his time trying to go through the family to get to her. And he obviously got to her through other routes.
Here's a question for you.
She was absolutely 100% willing to do that.
No
doubt.
And you're right.
She was somehow coerced into it.
Is nonsense.
Is absolutely ridiculous.
Nonsense. Listen, there are ethics around our job. There are things you shouldn't do. Now, am I going to sit here and lie and say that I've not sometimes, well, not recently, but in the past, have I bent the truth a little bit to get an interview? I suppose the worst I've ever done over the years is tell stories about how large the audience is sometimes. I've invited people on, how big is your audience? And way back when I started out, I would indulge myself a little bit and say that I had more listeners than I actually had. But I understand why Bashir did it, and everything about the interview from then on in was good. Listen,
it's an important question of journalistic ethics.
Yeah.
But I call it Roger Cook syndrome, because if you're not going to con somebody, you're not going to have a journalistic sting in order to... I mean, basically, the way it works is... I mean, I had to go through this several times in various undercover filming I did. And what you do is you have to go to your editor, And you have to say, well, look, I want to use a technique which isn't a standard technique in order to get this interview or to get this piece of audio or video. And you have to justify it. So in other words, you have to show, in a way, like a court case, in a way. So you've got to show that there is evidence that this person, whoever they are, that you're targeting with a stick, with a sting, has done something wrong or possibly criminal or whatever. And it's got to be. And the trouble is, as soon as you go to an editor nowadays with any information like that, they will pass it up the chain.
And
it will get to, you know, whatever, security services or whatever, and the whole thing will be shut down before you've even started. So this is the problem, is that the bureaucracy has made it almost impossible to do anything like this ever again. The Roger Cook program, I'm sure you remember.
Oh, what a program.
You know, week after week after week after week, he was doing these journalistic stings left, right and centre through Central Television, and they were the best, I mean, they were the best watched, the most popular current affairs TV journalism there's ever been.
It was brilliant, yeah.
And of course, the whole thing was shut down by Rupert Murdoch on the News of the World because he was actually doing a brilliant job for the public, and they didn't want the broadcasters to do that.
No, they certainly did not. Before we talk about Belarus, and when we do, we'll only have about 5 or 6 minutes. Was Diana's assassination ritualistic? Was it done in a way to signal to others in the hidden power structure that it had been done? Was it ritualistic? Was it done in that way?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I don't think so particularly. I mean, it was the actual choice of the Alma Tunnel was, according to the ex-MI6 officer Richard Tomlinson, who swore an affidavit back at the time, he was saying that that he'd seen plans to kill Slobodan Milosevic in a tunnel in a similar way. And he was rather shocked when he saw the way that Diana died, saying, you know, there would be vehicles around to coerce the vehicle to go faster, and then there'd be some sort of device to make it go sideways suddenly. And he, when he saw the way Diana had died, he immediately said, well, this is MI6 that have done this, and I've seen the plan that they didn't use against Milosevic. They've now used it against Diana.
MI6.
So I don't see it as a particularly ritualistic thing, no.
MI6, what about...
It was a practical assassination, Richie. This is how you kill people.
Do you know what? There are better ways of killing people. When I used to interview Noel, and I keep dropping Noel's name. I do miss Noel. He used to speak to me a lot when I was on radio in Spain, like you did. Lovely gentleman. When I used to speak to Noel, I used to say, well, there are better ways of assassinating somebody than sending guys to chase a very heavy and a very armoured Mercedes. I drove a very similar Mercedes when I lived in Spain. I'm not suggesting now for a minute that I could afford a car like that. I was able to get one for less than £1,000, a very old one. It was just massive. I can't imagine trying to kill somebody like that. But look, we won't go down that road. I want to talk for a moment about, we can certainly get into this in the future because it's very important.
Before we get off Diana, one of the most fascinating things that John Morgan explains is that Sherard Cowper-Coles, who's a Bilderberger and one of the directors now of BAE Systems, he was sent 2 weeks before to Paris in order to take over certain roles from the MI6 offices there, you know, the station in Paris. And he puts him down as the mastermind. So, you know, I think, you know, we on your show, we can name names. I think Cowper-Coles should be, you know, one of the people who's put in the dock and asked to answer questions about this, because where were you on the day? Who did you instruct to do X, Y, and Z? Because, of course, this is all, you know, he has protected himself by covering himself
in this
cloak of national security.
Yeah.
So you're never going to be able to ask another question at all about this.
It's nice that we name him on my show so that I can get sued for libel. That's lovely. Speaking of guys who ran operations, we could be here all night talking about George H.W. Bush, the only man in the world who didn't remember, where he was on the day that John F. Kennedy was murdered. And that's because he was in Dallas overseeing the operation, my opinion. Now, we've got 6 minutes. Don't give me any guff now, Gosling. You're a radio presenter yourself. You're a radio presenter yourself, so you know we've got 6 minutes now. Tell me about this guy, this Roman Protasevich, who was allegedly kidnapped. He was taken off a flight that was diverted, a flight that was heading for Lithuania. The Belarusian authority sent up a fighter jet to force it to the ground, apparently because this guy has been very critical of the government. They've arrested him and his girlfriend. His family believes that he's been abused, he's been tortured. It looks pretty bad to me, T. The mainstream media is not wrong all the time. A broken clock is right twice a day. It looks like pretty bad behaviour by the Belarusians. What do you say?
Well, my union, the NUJ, has condemned it, and I can totally understand that. You know, everyone's entitled to their point of view. First of all, the fighters didn't force it to the ground. The pilot was ordered to land, which he
over
was willingly doing by the military in Belarus. And the fighters were there to what we might call escort it. So, in other words, they had a little bit of, I suppose, when Protasevich is looking out of his window and he sees a MiG sitting there, immediately nervous. But look, you know, they are actually, they've used a little bit of trickery here, but they are entitled to do this sort of thing in their own airspace. I think this is immensely significant, Richie, because it shows me we had a month or so ago the request of Putin for the American ambassador to leave Moscow and go back to Washington. Now, that followed a month previously the Moscow ambassador to Washington being withdrawn. Now, this is a permanent state of affairs now. So there's no Russian ambassador in Washington and no American ambassador in Moscow anymore. This has never happened before.
Never.
Not even during the Russian Revolution, not during World War II, not during the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is immensely, immensely significant. The media is not talking about it at all. What it says to me is that the Russians, their intelligence services have picked up that the Americans and NATO generally are up to something this summer, and that they are sending a message to the world to say that whatever they're planning, they're obviously not telling us what they're planning something which is going to be devastating. Now, whether it's summer or autumn, God knows. But anyway, by withdrawing their ambassadors, they're saying, right, well, we're ready to fight you now. So they're not actually... I don't think they're pushing the fight. They're saying we're ready to respond to whatever you do. So this is the backdrop to which this is happening. And when we see Protasevich force is playing force to the ground, what the Russian intelligence service, they've still got a KGB in Belarus, so this is in conjunction, I imagine, with the FSB in Russia, is they have identified the ringleaders of the anti-democratic rallies that took place after the election in Belarus. And the way that Putin operates, I think, is extremely professional in terms of policing, right? So he identifies who the top people are who've been organizing political subversion in Belarus in this case, and he keeps a very close eye on them. And when they see an opportunity to apprehend him, he's the guy they get. They don't bother with anybody else, the low-hanging fruit. They get the top guy, right? So this guy, he's only 23 years old. So he was 22, I think, when all this kicked off. A very young person, a young hothead recruited by the Western intelligence services, very much like Victoria Nuland was paying her billions to get ferment dissent and demonstrations in Ukraine back in 2014, 2015, etc. And they've decided, right, if we get this guy, it's going to send a clear message to everybody else who knows what his role was, that this is what happens if you try and organize subversion in Belarus or any other country which is under the Russian sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. And this is, I think, a very clear message to the West. There's no more messing about at all. And this is, I think, all relating to this breakdown in diplomatic relations between Moscow and Washington.
Very interesting analysis there. Look, the guy's a journalist. Regardless of whether what he does is deemed to be subversive, it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong to be kidnapping a journalist and his girlfriend. And if he has had his nose broken and been beaten up, it's outrageous.
No, it's not. If there's a warrant out for this guy's arrest in Belarus, if he's in a Belarus airspace, they're quite within their rights to arrest him, particularly if he is the main instigator and he's trying to avoid being in the country so he doesn't get arrested. If he flies over the country, whoopsie daisy, matey, you just made a big mistake there.
But it is an authoritarian. Hang on. Belarus, like it or lump it, like Russia, is an authoritarian setup. Listen, I've been quite happy with Vladimir. Let me finish. I've been very.
Democracy.
Hang on. I've been very complimentary, I suppose, over the years, in recent years, about the Putin administration's approach to Syria. and which I think has been hugely important. I believe Russia does as much and as little. It does no more in terms of espionage than anybody else. When I hear these stories about Russia trying to interfere in elections here and in America, I laugh my ass off. It's ridiculous. It's the pot calling the kettle black and all of that. But I take a more rounded and a more broad view of Putin. Putin's a gangster. He's an absolute gangster, Vladimir Putin. He used the Sochi Olympics to basically spread hundreds of millions of euro around his own bank accounts and the bank accounts of his friends. I have no doubt he's been involved in killing people over the years, a former KGB agent. And he's basically been running Russia for years and years and years with little opposition. Whatever way you describe him, it's an authoritarian setup. It's the same in Belarus.
No, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong, Richie.
You will prove me wrong then.
The reason you're wrong is because Putin is extremely popular in Russia. He has no trouble winning genuine elections. And if you talk to people on the street, as we did when I was there, they think he's great. They think, you know what, one of the people I was chatting with was saying, he's a good manager. We can see it all over this country. The roads are being improved. The cities are improving. Everything is on the up. If you go to Moscow today, it's a bit like the 1960s London, Carnaby Street. The young people are thriving. There's loads of job opportunities over there. We don't see any of this on the media over here.
But he's had his opponents killed over the years. He kills his opponents, too.
Yes, he's a gangster. Yes, he's a gangster.
I know.
All these leaders are gangsters.
But he's all right.
But he's made it absolutely clear to the financial elite. Let me get this point out.
Okay.
He's made it very clear to the financial elite and the oligarchy that you can do your gangster stuff in Russia, whatever you want to do, but you come anywhere near the Kremlin, soon as you touch politics in this country, I'm going to chop your fingers off.
That makes
him
even worse.
You're either going to be arrested or you're going to be deported.
That makes him even worse. That makes him even worse. That makes him even worse. Okay, gangsters, you can fuck up. You can fuck Russia. You can rob and pillage and plunder Mother Russia all you want. Just don't come near the Kremlin, and we'll be okay.
Listen, we're far worse here. We have gangsters running the show.
I agree.
But he's made sure that the financial elite in Russia can do the stuff that they need to do, but as soon as they start encroaching on the Kremlin, which is, you know, is running the country and running it very well these days, according to the Russians themselves, very popular leader, genuinely popular, you know, far more than our Western leaders and European leaders, who are mostly despised by the population. You know, when it comes to an election here, we have to choose between the worst of three
absolute
or four
garbage,
or one or two, you know.
Yeah. I give you that.
He is popular. I'm sorry, you can't get away from the fact that Putin is popular genuinely amongst the Russian population. He is.
You've been there and I haven't, so I'm going to give you the final word on that. That was the final word. Mwinga says on Twitter, very good, get Tony back for an hour soon to talk about Diana. Let's do that. We can talk about Diana and other high-profile assassinations. It'll give both of us a nice break from talking about coronavirus. Thanks as always, mate, for coming on. Thisweek.org.uk, Friday, the politics show, Tony Gosling and a cast of thousands. If you want to hear doctors, scientists, if you want to hear academics, if you want to hear politicians that you don't hear on the BBC and on Sky News, you will hear them on Tony's programme. Top man, T, thanks for coming on again today, mate.
God bless. Thank you.
As always, buddy, thank you. Tony Gosling with the last word there on Vladimir Putin. It's exactly 6 o'clock. You're with the Richie Allen radio show, which is live from Salford. Now, John Waters will be with me live. I don't know if John is in Offaly. I don't know if he's in Ballia Ohaclea, but he's in God's country and he'll be with me right soon. I will, of course, read your comments when I come back after this from Ty Dolls. I don't know. I just dug it out. It dawned on me 15 seconds ago you don't have a track. So I just dug out the Ty Dolls. It's a bit of a gimmick. It's a bit of a novelty song, I suppose.
Stop. Thank you.
Bit of cheese.
Stop. Thank you. Stop.
I could have played Glory, Stop. Glory Man United, but I wouldn't subject you to that, Stop. You know.
This one's called Nelly the Elephant.
Yes. Yeah, it's exactly 3 minutes past six. Ty Dolls. And it's more like 4 minutes past six if you want to be precise about it. Ty Dolls, Nelly the Elephant, having a clue what year, having a Scooby-Doo. Doesn't really matter, does it? Listen, my next guest is no stranger to you. He's a great, great writer. He really is. You know, I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. Brilliant writer, brilliant journalist. read him for years and years and years in the Irish broadsheets, and was lucky enough to hear him quite a lot on radio during my days as a radio producer. I would like you to check out johnwaters.substack.com. johnwaters.substack.com, because that is where you can read him today. And I strongly recommend you subscribe to him. Okay, do, please. Great John Waters back on the radio show today. John, thanks for coming back on. Love to have you on the show. You're very welcome back. How are you?
Thanks very much, Richie. I'm very well. Well, delighted to be with you.
Brilliant, brilliant, mate. Do you know, I was thinking of you today when I was in touch with a couple of people back home, and we were talking about the lady from Bandon in Cork, whose name is Margaret, I believe.
Yes.
Her being sent to prison, even if only for an evening, by a judge in Cork last week because she refused to wear a mask and was maybe a little bit rude, but does it really matter, to a supermarket manager. I listen, you can't sensationalise stuff like this. I never thought I would live to see the day when a pensioner would be banged up because she doesn't accept being muzzled. An intervention that has there's no proof that it's any good or does anybody any good at all. She ends up in prison. I mean, even for yourself, looking back at what's happened in the last 12 to 14 months, were you horrified, shocked by that?
Oh, completely, Richie. I mean, I wrote something about it, like I could not believe. And what I was trying to articulate was that this judge probably doesn't see himself as I see him, and as I think he really is, which is the kind of judge who would have sent Jews to prison for refusing to wear the yellow star of David.
Yeah,
he cannot see that. And this is a symptom of our where we are now. The lecturing that he gave this poor woman, you know, who had simply said to this guy, I don't wear a mask. And she's quite entitled under the law to declare herself exempt. And there is no provision in the law, contrary to what the authorities or the flunkies of the authorities consistently state, in Ireland at least, there is no provision for any kind of letter or certification from any doctor to say you are exempt. There's no requirement of that whatsoever, nor is there any provision for it. Because if there was a provision, at least you could go to your doctor, subject yourself to examination and get a letter. At the present, because there is no such provision, the doctors are simply refusing to issue letters. And this, I believe, is a particularly malicious design feature of the entire edifice of so-called laws. And this woman refused, said, no, I don't wear it. Now, you see, this has unleashed on our societies a whole raft of little Hitlers working in little jobbies in supermarkets and all the rest of it, who delight in destroying the life of somebody like this, getting her thrown in prison because he can sort of exert his, you know, camp commandant powers over her, you know, or under Sturmfuhrer authority. That's what happened. And of course, the judge, a man beyond the word stupidity, the reach of the word stupidity, lectured this woman about the danger to society.
Yeah,
and
right.
You see, we come back to one of the central contradictions of all this. And I don't want to go into too much complexity now, but the laws in Ireland are based on a 1947 Health Act. If you can imagine, there's like three elements to it. There's the 47 Health Act, then there's a whole barrage of 2020 laws, three or four of them, and out of that then is concocted rather than constructed these series of regulations which are simply drafted by a minister. Now, by the time when you started the 47 Health Act, you're dealing essentially with a pretty humane piece of legislation, which was designed predominantly for tuberculosis, you know, which was quite a dangerous disease at that time in Ireland. And it's designed so that infected persons could be quarantined, you know, and looked after, treated, in other words. We had things like in Ireland that were called sanatoriums. We had one in our hometown in Castlereagh in the west of Ireland, a sanatorium. And Dr. Noel Brown was the guy who was the minister at the time, dealing with all this stuff, and a very famous doctor and a very good man, you know. And but this act is designed to help sick people. It's designed to help parents of children who might be infected. It's all that's the logic of it. That's the tenor of it. That's the spirit of it. But by the time you get to the regulations, three steps away, you are essentially deep into fascism. You're deep into fascism. The very first statement by an Irish official figure in relation to COVID-19 that I came across was on March the 6th of 2020, when the Garda Commissioner, the police commissioner of the National Police Force, Drew Harris, we call him now, announced with some glee that he would have the power very soon to arrest people who refused to be quarantined. Now, this was before anybody had, I think there were two people sick with this so-called pandemic at that time. Nobody had died. And the one thing this man was looking forward to was gleefully rubbing his hands at the idea that he would be able to drag people out of their homes into the backs of police vans, Black Mariahs, and put them into some kind of secure accommodation. Now, this is actually, we have this now. I mean, like, we had a bizarre situation, like a comical situation, where the Italian government recently had to really lecture the Irish government about their decline into fascism. This is not a joke.
No.
The inventors of fascism are now looking askance at Ireland and saying, God almighty, what the fuck are you people doing there? Are you going crazy? Because they're locking up Italians when they come into Ireland for 2 weeks and making them pay for the privilege. It's unbelievable, Richie. It's unbelievable. But going back to Mrs. Buttermer was her name.
And, Margaret Buttermer. The judge was
Mrs. Buttermer, Margaret Buttermer, a wonderful woman. And you know, it struck me when I was listening, when I was reading the report, and what actually happened in the end, I believe, just to kind of cut to the end, for she was back, she was in court on last week, and she was back in court then on Friday. She was in early in the week and in a different place. I think she was originally in Clonakilty, town of Clonakilty, and then she was in another Cork town, Bandon. On Friday, on the same charge, or a similar charge, not the same charge, a similar charge. She'd been caught more than once. And the judge, then she would, in Bandon, apparently she refused, fair play to her, she refused to wear a mask in the court. And she was cited for contempt by this ass of a judge, right? Yeah,
Colin Roberts.
Roberts, yeah. And he cited for contempt and put to jail for the weekend. Now, there were a number of extraordinary things about it. Like, one was that she had a solicitor there who, God almighty, you know, I hope she wasn't paying the man, because he said absolutely nothing in her defense except more or less to throw up his hands and say, well, she wasn't going to wear a mask, judge. You know, I'm sorry now, but that's the way it is. You know, I'm told. These are my instructions. That was the general vibe. This solicitor should have been actually telling the judge that there is no basis for any of this law, that it has never been established that there's any benefit whatsoever from these masks, and that they are actually potentially a danger to the health of the wearer. But no, the system is acting in concert on all of these questions.
Yeah, lockstep.
And this woman, I mean, my heart goes out to her. I mean, it's strange. I find it bizarre, Richard, you know, because she's 66 years of age, you know, and I hear her described as a pensioner. I'm going to be 66 on Friday. You know?
Are you? Wow.
But yeah. I won't be getting a pension, Richie. That's the problem. I mean, I could live with it a bit better if I was getting the pension, but they've put off the pension now to 67. And by the time I get there, it'll be 68 and so on.
By the time you get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. I'm hearing you loud and clear. Let me just, can I take you back to something you said a few minutes ago? Very, very profound. You talked about Colin Roberts and you said that he might have been a guy that sent a Jewish person to prison for not wearing the yellow star. So I want to ask you about this. I've got friends in Manchester who are Jewish people, and we talk sometimes. I'm very much a kind of an anti-Israeli person. I don't like Israel. I don't like what Israel does. And we often discuss how does the Israeli state, how does it do things to Palestinian men, women and children? Things that were done to Jews in Nazi Germany. How can that happen? Now, you've opened up a can of worms for me. How can Irish men and Irish women do things to people that were done to Irish men and women by the British Empire. How is that possible? I mean, this is extraordinary. How have we not learned? How could we not be completely anti that type of fascism?
Well, Richie, that's a very interesting and profound question. And I'll take a stab at answering it. You know, I think that we have fundamentally misunderstood human nature in our public culture. In the way that, you see, our culture tends to go into piety and sentimentality very easily and stay there. And, you know, you'll never lose any points for saying something completely pious and anodyne in a public context, right? You know, if you say, Richie, well, I'm opposed to plane crashes. I'm vehemently opposed to plane crashes. People will applaud you. Yeah. If you go on a chat show, they'll give you a good clap for saying that. That's the kind of culture we have. Right? And that then, so it's very easy to kind of for people to imagine that they're all very good. It's very interesting. Like, if you to slightly deviate, like in the, I'll come back to this point, but this is the same point. In the last few days, we've had the leaders of Western societies, of countries, in Ireland and Britain and all over the place in Europe, the leader of the European Union, condemning Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus. Now, I'm no doubt that he's a complete asshole. Let's not be no doubt about that. But they don't seem to have any sense of the mote in their own eye.
No.
You know, they don't seem like they're talking without irony about that they want to force these people to accept Western values. You know, they've locked people in their homes for the last 14 months. They're stopping people in the streets going about their business. They're handcuffing people. They're dragging them into the backs of vans. They're strip searching them. What sort of Western values are you talking about, for Christ's sake? You know, like, this is the thing. And this is what I mean. You see, that we have, you see, this is the thing. You think, well, okay, what is this now, Richie? And what I'm coming to the answer to your question, I think, or this is my stab at it. That, you see, it seems that this propaganda, this absolute torrent of propaganda that has been generated by these people affects also themselves. In other words, we're like in a massive bunker of lies where no truth is visible and there's no window to look out to see the truth. So all you see is the walls of lies all the time. And I think politicians start to believe it. And they really do now believe that they're doing this to save lives and, you know, for the sake of the health of the people. They're locking the people up. They're beating them across the heads in the street for the sake of their health. They really do believe that, you know. And that brings us to the point here. It was well established in a number of the Stanford Prison Experiment back in the 70s and the Milgram Experiment, I think it was in the 60s, a decade before that. These were experiments which are done really going into the, drilling into the very nature of the human person. Experiments, the Milgram Experiment was where the members of the public were recruited and then they were required to administer electric shocks to people who were not visible to them in another room in the interest, they were told, of research into educational methods, right? And once they were told, Rich, and they were told this was very important for science, very important for the future of understanding of these things. Once they were told that, Richie, they were more than delighted to give it Wasky with the buzzer.
To shock people, yeah.
Yes, and you could hear the roars. There's films online if people want to check it out. And you can hear the roars. Now, they're actually actors. And they're not particularly good actors. I want you to know they're not. They're all the actors. You kind of know that they are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not very good actors. But the person there would be a slight hesitation, like, and then the guy saying, "Oh no, you have to do it," and away he go again. You know, and that's the point, Richie. I think that once you give people license to say they're doing something good, they will do the greatest evils imaginable or unimaginable.
You talked about propaganda. I don't think you will have heard this. You've got better things to be doing than listening to my old guff on the Richie Allen radio show. I'm well aware of that. So you probably won't have heard this. And I never missed a chance to play these two very short clips. It's only 16 seconds. Listen to Matthew. Matthew is genuine. He is a caller to the BBC Radio 5 Live breakfast programme. And if you want to know how successful the government and media propaganda on coronavirus has been, just listen to Matthew. They're all getting upset about the refuseniks, the people who won't take a vaccine. Listen to this, John. This is going to cheer you right up. This is Matthew.
Why on earth should somebody who has refused to have it take a bed that I might need if I have a bad reaction to it?
Did you get that? Do you want me to play it again?
Why on earth should somebody who has refused to have it take a bed that I might need if I have a bad reaction to it?
Why is somebody who refused to take the vaccine, why should they get a bed if they get sick that should be reserved for me if I have an adverse event? And don't come in just yet. Wait for this. He says this then. This is comedy gold, but he means it. And I meet these guys around Salford. Listen to this.
I had the vaccine. It put me in hospital for a day. But I haven't moaned. I've had the second one, and he put me in hospital for another day.
Had the vaccine. Well, have you ever heard anything like that in your life? Are you still there?
He'll be still cheering it from the mortuary, you know?
Fantastic.
He'll be in the coffin there, and he's saying, I took the vaccine. Yeah. Come on, you better line up and take it too.
Yeah.
But listen, he reminded me actually of what something sinister that judge said. It's just come back into my mind. Again, I'll come back to this. But he actually said to this woman, that, you know, well, if you're not prepared to wear the mask, then you're entitled to not wear a mask, but you're entitled to stay out of the shop. So what he was actually saying to this woman, you're entitled to starve to death.
Yeah, if you don't, yeah. Don't comply.
According to this judge, representing the Irish state, people can starve to death if they're not prepared to humiliate themselves and risk their health by wearing this dirty rag on their face. Now, that guy there, you see, that's the logic. That's the propaganda. I mean, I've gone into this to some extent, but I'm doing it as a layman, you know. And I think I've touched on this before with you, the whole question of mass hypnosis, which operates on the reptilian brain, you know, and it works on emotion, high emotion, and in this case, fear. And once you've actually got in there with your little, as it were, vaccine or your inoculation of fear, there's no possibility that any common sense will ever penetrate in there again until you get a similar deprogramming process to remove that hypnoidal spell that has been cast over your brain.
So there's no chance then. Can I, sorry for interjecting, because you're in a great flow there. I don't like interrupting. What you're saying is ultimately, once they've gone down the road of Matthew, had me jab, went to hospital, had me second one, went to hospital, and the refuseniks shouldn't be allowed into hospital. The beds should be reserved for me if I get another adverse reaction. There's no hope for him then.
Well, you see, this is a very dark place we're going to, Richie, unless this is stopped. Because now we're only a step away from, you know, the Yellow Star of David, where you will actually have to wear some kind of badge or mark in order to demonstrate that you haven't taken the vaccine, or conversely, maybe that vaccinated people will wear this badge of so-called honour.
We're there already, aren't we? With the vaccine passports, we're already there, aren't we?
Well, we're a step away from it yet, in the sense that you can still walk around the street
and
nobody will know. But we're coming to that stage next, and they will be clamouring for that next. And then what will actually happen, I believe, people will be beaten to a pulp in the street by maniacs. If they don't have this badge, this emblem on them. That's where we're going. In other words, Richie, we're saying that we're in the last days of what we deemed our civilization. And that's not an exaggeration, in my opinion. We're actually now, we have actually demolished our civilization over the past 14 months. And the only thing that has actually concealed that is the fact that the lockdown has actually, in a certain sense, put everything on kind of, in a kind of a freeze mode, where we're kind of like on a life support, economically and culturally and socially and otherwise. But as soon as you push that button and everything then starts to really activate again, you will see these sentiments now erupting, where there's they have been inculcated into people. The hypnosis has actually inculcated a hatred of anybody who doesn't share the view that has been implanted with you. And that's where we're going next. That's the next phase. I think it's going to be very, very ugly and very dangerous. And I would seriously say to people, you know, if you live in the country, in the countryside, fair play to you. Well done. That's a good idea. If you don't, and you have country cousins, I'd seriously think about, if they're decent minded people, think about visiting them for an extended period in the coming year.
I would have previously jumped on you there for talking about people getting beaten up in the streets, and I would have jumped all over you. But the reason I haven't is because I bore witness last week to pretty much every mainstream, every prime time radio and television anchor doing very dangerous monologues, incitement to hatred monologues, basically yes. describing refuseniks as dangerous. Divide of morality, awful people, won't do yes. the right thing by their countrymen, are putting people at risk, all of them, right across, and I'm not exaggerating, right across Sky, the BBC, LBC Radio, Talk Radio. So you saying that it might come to mobs of people descending on a man or a woman demanding to know if they're vaccinated, you might be right.
It's very important to understand, Richie, that this has been arrived at without really any significant evidence in real life of any problem.
You're gone a little bit muffled there, John, just a little bit muffled.
It's very important to stress that this has been conducted without there being any evidence, concrete evidence, of anything remotely like a pandemic. Like, the evidence for all this has been in the media. This is the strange thing. That's the bunker. The evidence is the propaganda. There is no other evidence. In Ireland, you know, it's very interesting, and I won't go into much detail about the figures, but if you were to do an exercise, like we had a spike in deaths, yes, we did, in April of last year, and you would say, okay, there was a pandemic. Well, no, because then what actually you noticed was that the numbers leveled out over the summer, so that over the full span of March to December, there was actually a lower death toll overall than there would have been in the previous couple of years.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So this is very interesting, you see. But because of the deep corruption of the mainstream legacy media, this is not being adverted to at all. And so what people are hearing is simply the hysteria, the exaggeration, the lies, the propaganda, all this, all of it generated by vested interests. The big pharma and its representatives, the medical profession and its representatives, you know, the people who are actually, you know, actively leading up these campaigns in all our countries, are all people who, when you dig into it, have vested huge financial vested interests in various aspects of whether it's the vaccination industry, the general pharmaceutical industry, or whatnot. This is very commonplace. Whereas there are all these other people, scientists, doctors, who have been talking like until they're blue in the face for the past year or more, who don't have vested interest in what they're saying. They're saying this is all nonsense. They're saying it's all, you know, lies. They're saying, they're actually explaining methodically, you know, how this works. There is theory, like there's a brilliant scientist I've talked to, Denis Rancour in Canada, who's done this extraordinary analysis where he's demonstrated that the spike that I mentioned in April of last year, which occurred in Ireland and in other countries, not every country, but quite a lot of countries around the world, and he's drilled into lots of them, was created by stress in nursing homes. In other words, it was old people whose immune systems were destroyed by the panic that was imposed upon them by the media and by the government. And that's why they died. They died early. They might have died in a month or 6 months, but they died in April because of the stress. And this has been inflated. These lies then have been generated and repeated and repeated. This is the greatest crime, I think, you know, undoubtedly. You know, when I use the language of Nazism, I'm not being rhetorical, Richie, please believe me. I'm actually factually describing, because this is how it always starts. And what you can see now in the mindset of these judges and the rhetoric that they use against ordinary decent, a decent woman like who has had no criminal record, a decent mother, you know, I mean, it's just heartbreaking in many respects. But he starts lecturing as if she was a common criminal, you know, and treating her as if she's some kind of danger to society
yeah.
when she's a decent, kind soul who wants people to, you know, have sense and live their lives, go back to their happy lives and their content, you know, live their lives while they have them, like, for Christ's sake.
There was a time when a judge would have said to the lady, Margaret Buttermer, Mrs. Buttermer, I don't know what you're doing here, Mrs. Buttermer, I'm sorry you're here. Listen, you're immediately discharged.
Yes.
Go about your business. I interviewed 10 or so days ago, Cindy Connolly. Now, I'm sure you're aware of Cindy's story. She came over from London, Irish woman. From Dublin, came over from London to take care of her dad, passed one of these lateral flow tests in London, got into Dublin. They said, you passed the wrong test. And then, without telling her, where she was going without having the kindness to say, even as bad as it is, you know, we're taking you to a quarantine hotel. She was taken by people wearing military uniforms onto a bus. And she told that story to me. And again, you know, having grown up in the media in the 90s, I'm just a little bit younger than you, you know, presented and produced talk radio programs. I'm like, I can't believe this is Ireland. How could this be possible?
Richie, I remember about 3 or 4 months ago picking up that guy Varadkar, that awful creep that was our Taoiseach and is now our Taoiseach.
Yeah.
He used a phrase which I found chilling, and it's the kind of phrase which again belongs in the depths of Nazi Germany. He talked about these so-called quarantine centres in hotels, and then he used this phrase that people would be taken there in secure transport.
Did he?
He did. Secure transport. Think about that, Richie. Think about that phrase coming from a democratically elected politician in a supposedly free democratic
like they are terrorists or criminals of some description.
Yeah. And that this has been allowed to happen. My disgraceful former profession of journalism has stood by, and actually not alone, they didn't just stand by, they participated in the Nazi escapade. That's what they did. That's what they're doing. They are Nazis themselves. This is unbelievable stuff, Richie. And this, for a fictitious pandemic, completely fictitious. It's unbelievable. And I just don't know what to say anymore about Richie. I've said everything. I've said myself out on this. I can't really think of new words. It's very interesting. You know, I'm doing my blog, you know, and sometimes the more than yourself, I have to say, fuck this, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do. And sometimes I write it down, Richie. And this, I met a man in a shop. There's only one shop in Dublin that I'm allowed into now, you know. And I was in there. It's a charity shop. I shouldn't mention it because it'll be closed down, you know. So I won't mention the name. But they sell knickknacks, and there's a little room with books in it, and there's another room with clothes in it. And I just go in there and spend 10 or 15 minutes. And it makes me feel human to be in there just looking at things and maybe to come away buying a book or something like that. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I do.
But this day I was in there and this man came up to me and he actually turned out that he was subscribed to my site, you know. And he said, John, and he's a very gentle man. And he says to me, John, he says, do you mind if I say something to you a little bit critical? And I says, no, go ahead. Sure, I says, everyone else is an editor. Why would you not? And he says, well, it's just now, sometimes your language, you know, it's a bit strong, you know. And people, like the kind of people that be reading that, like they wouldn't be expecting it, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, I understand what you're saying. And I did, because that thought has gone in my head as well. But what I said to him was this, Richie. I said, but you know, we're in this situation, and we don't have any words to describe it.
No, none.
And so we are, the only way that I can express what is down in my heart and in my gut about this is to say, fuck it!
Yeah. Yeah, go to the deepest recesses of your soul and scream it out. I'm the same, I get tongue-tied during, when I do the monologue segment of the programme, I get tongue-tied. What can you say when you hear this lunacy? Yesterday afternoon, by the way, folks, John Waters can be found at johnwaters.substack.com. Please support independent journalists like John. You have to do it. Because when he's gone, when he's not writing his brilliant blogs and articles, there's nobody left doing it. And he writes prose, he writes poetry, this man. Right, he writes in a way that I can only dream of writing like, so support him, johnwaters.substack.com. Yesterday morning, on the national media, I threw a piece on my website about it. They're talking about sniffer dogs in airports, running up to people and identifying people who might have the virus because they've trained dogs to sniff or to smell the virus, apparently. They're talking about that. They're talking about it like it's a good thing. Two dogs can run through a plane of 300 people in a half an hour. And if they do have, if the dog does identify them, those people can then be taken away to be given a PCR test. And you mentioned Nazism a couple of times tonight. I can't think of anything more Nazi than that, John. A perfectly healthy person who isn't coughing, who isn't sneezing, who's come into a country, happy to see their relatives. I can't wait till I get into arrivals. Give me mum a hug or me dad a hug. And you're going to have dogs running around you. What the fuck is right?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I had an experience actually 30 years ago with something like that in an airport. It was to do with drugs.
Drugs.
And it's the only time it ever happened to me where we were, I was coming from Gibraltar, I think. And we were, it was the time of the IRA inquest over there. Do you remember that?
I do.
Years and years ago. And we were in this, and the next thing they brought this dog in. We were there in this room. And he was around and he sniffed every one of them. I have never had anything so humiliating in all my life.
Yeah.
Because what my feeling was instantly, Richie, was we are the dogs.
Yeah, you're the dog.
We are the dogs. We are the dogs. He is the superior being. And we are the dogs. And that, so what you've said there is actually where we're going now. You see, at the heart of all of this, Richie, I talked about this in a clip, which I was down in Castlebar Court last July. And I was, somebody put a phone in front of me or a mic or something and asked me a question. And out came this thing about what I said was what they're trying to do is actually tell us all, to insinuate to us all that we are nothing but, you know, a festering mess of microbes and pathogens to be avoided at all costs. So that we actually are getting to the point now where the human being is a leper to himself, to each other. We are lepers to each other, and we are to shout unclean, unclean before us as we walk down the street. That's where these bastards want to take us to, something like this.
Something
they
like
don't
that,
include themselves in that, by the way. They regard themselves as ipso facto superior beings, the likes of Radker and Johnson and all these scum. That's where I do believe they're going to take us. They have utterly, fundamentally altered human culture, Richie. You know, even if they stopped this tonight at midnight and we were to be told next morning that it's all over now, you can go back to normal, that would be meaningless. Because, first of all, there would be the fear that it could be reintroduced at any time. Once you've had this, you can't unring the bell, you know? You can't unring the bell. That's the one thing. But the other thing is that they have now conditioned us to behave in certain ways. I wrote a thing recently about this, actually, about comparing it to the way that the horse trainer introduces the bit and bridle and the harness to the horse. Where gradually the bridle is, the smell is introduced first, and then the touch of the bridle, and then what the trainer does, he puts it on for a minute or so, and then he takes it off again to reassure the horse that it's okay to be taken off. But of course, once it's put on, it is on for good. In a sense, it doesn't matter how many times you take it off, you put it, it will go back again. You are now broken.
That's a brilliant analogy. Stay there for a second. I'm going to play you a 60-second bit of audio because I know this is news to you now because you just told me it's news about the dogs. Listen to a woman who's involved in a company, a very big company that trains dogs to do this. She's speaking on Sky News yesterday morning and she describes dogs as not as dogs. A dog isn't a dog. A dog is a biosensor that has a fluffy tail and fluffy ears. Listen to the language, John. John Waters is our guest, folks. We heard this on Monday. Listen to this closely.
Well, I mean, that's a very good point. And, you know, at the charity, we've been working for over 10 years now to get an evidence base to actually show that although these biosensors have got a fluffy coat and wacky tail and in this case, a very fluffy top knot, you know, he is a very, very accurate biosensor. And I think the scepticism is that, you know, well, how can a dog possibly do this? But of course, we use these dogs to keep us safe in terms of finding drugs, explosives, and, you know, they are relied upon to keep us safe. And this is just another application of the dog's incredible sense of smell and his willingness to look for odour. And, you know, the scepticism is slowing things down. You know, we need to get these dogs out there as soon as we can to assist in this fight against COVID-19, just like they assist in the fight against terrorism and explosions. So, you know, this is a very, very serious, serious sign. behind all our work.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to take it.
Needless to say, the presenter didn't ask any questions. So the dogs are biosensors. They help us fighting terrorism and they help us fighting drugs and they find guns. We need to do it quick. And she said that basically skepticism is slowing us down and needs to be eliminated. We need to get dogs into airports, yeah, train stations quickly. This is where we are.
Well, you see, at the back of that, you see, you can hear the echo of the ethic. The pseudo-ethic, that is, we're doing good. This is necessary. So once you have that license, you can do what you like. You can do anything to human beings once you do that, once you have justification. And I've seen a lot of that in the last 13 months with the what we call it, the police force here, En Garde Síochána. We call them En Gestapo Síochána. And the brutality towards people, their absolutely ugliness of them, suddenly out of nowhere, like, and they're all trained up and they jump out of the back of vans with batons and they're laying into people, you know. And this is where we're going. And I want to say where we're going, because I think that this is the part that people really don't get or don't understand.
But they need to hear it.
And this is because this is where the language thing, the failure of language. And I'll try now to say the following without using any F words or any words like that.
Don't worry about it, John.
Because this is a way of actually saying it, right? That if you were to look at an axis of human civilization, you'd be looking back to the very first earliest stirrings of democracy to ancient Greece, which is 2,700 years ago, roughly, right? Now, that's a narrow span, actually, oddly enough, in the whole span of human history, since Homo sapiens first appeared on the Earth. But actually, in the vast majority of cases, it's a much narrower band than that. I mean, in Ireland, we're less than 100 years of democracy or any kind of freedom, if we can even say we had it. Now, but this is the terrifying thing, that actually, we always thought, because we buy into this book, bullshit about progress, that included progress in terms of freedom and democracy. Now we're understanding that is not actually part of the deal at all. That actually the progress means progress in terms of controlling people and policing people and tyrannizing people, because that is the preferred model and has been the preferred model in virtually the entirety of human history for actually dealing with the governance of human society. And the point I'm making is that, Richie, that having come, we're now at the end of the democratic band, whatever color that was, it is now died out. And we're entering now an era which is akin to the previous eras, the eras of pharaohs and sultans and emperors and kings, where the ordinary person was no more than a serf or a slave. And that's where they're taking us. That is their attitude to it. That woman you play there, that is her attitude to the human race. Yeah. She doesn't consider herself, because she believes, this is a mistake I've noticed in this, because they don't understand that they're actually serfs too. They don't actually get it, because they think they have power. They have power for a brief moment. And they think that power is permanent, it is eternal. It's not. Once they do it to me, they do it to themselves. 5 minutes later, it will happen to them. And that's the real trick, you see, that these people, the elites, have been able to pull. That they've been actually managed to recruit the security forces of the world, the police forces of the world, the judiciaries of the world, the political establishments of the world, to their mission, which is to enslave the human race, to re-enslave the human race. And these gobshites don't understand that they're actually the same as us, really. It will happen to them 5 minutes after it happens to us.
Yeah, it's kind of like, here's a lot of money and a nice house. Go and build a jail for those people there. And then when it's built, it's a case of now you get in there with them, more or less, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It's astonishing.
You had that, by the way. You had that actually in the death camps, you know. You had a superior kind of Jew. But they were all killed in the end anyway.
Of course they were.
You know, they policed their own people. They tyrannized their own people on behalf of the Nazis. They picked the ones who would die, and so on and so forth. But they died themselves at the end. And that's what always happens to collaborators, because they get less respect than even the people who defy, than the refuseniks. Because at least the refuseniks have the dignity of knowing that they're human by saying no. And that's why I salute Margaret Buttermer and all the Margaret Buttermers that we have left in the world who will stand up to these bastards while there is still a chance.
While there is still a chance, John. Can I ask you a question, not to be in any way disrespectful to anybody who has faith, because even though I don't feel like I have any faith, I've become more and more respectful in the last couple of years to people who do have faith. Sure. But I have over the years, of course, been to Mass and I have spoken to priests, some of whom I found to be lovely blokes, and I chatted with them. It seems to me that some of this that we are witnessing now that is happening to us, it resonates with some of the stuff that I've read in the Bible. You know, you talk about the mark of the beast, and again, not to be flippant or in any way disrespectful, it's almost like some of this has been foretold. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. There's another way of seeing that, Richie, which is that these guys are actually gaslighting the human race by actually making it appear that the Bible is coming true.
Right, right.
That's a possibility. You know what I mean? That these guys are so sick that that's the kind of the thing they would do. For a laugh. I mean, you know the way that the number 666 keep coming up now and again.
Yeah, all the time,
You know, all the time. That this can't be random, you know, it can't be accidental. You see, there's very dark sides to all this, you know. I noticed at a very early stage, well over a year ago, actually, or about a year ago, there was an episode here where the then Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, was, you know, and this is at the height of the lockdown now. And you weren't allowed to have picnics. And the next thing, he was out in the Phoenix Park.
He was, wasn't he?
Shirt off in a picnic with his gay friends. And they were rubbing each other's tummies and so whatnot, you know. It struck me immediately, this is really a kind of a sadomasochistic kind of impulse, that he is the master in the midst of all the slaves, you know, gloating at what he's able to do to them. To take their rights away, to take their freedom away, to stop them having picnics. And here he is picnicking with his mates.
Flaunting it.
And the following day, his spokesperson said, oh, well, you know, that's just guidelines, you know. Like, everybody had been tyrannized for two months. Afraid to say boo, afraid to take a bottle of lemonade out of their satchel case they were going to be arrested.
Yeah.
He said, oh, no, it's just guidelines. These people are just taking the mickey in lots of ways. They're sick individuals. And that's, you know, I suppose that what would that response to them, and it is a legitimate and reasonable response, but with it goes a kind of powerlessness. It's a company. When I say that, I feel despair in myself welling up, because there's nothing we can do about it unless the majority of the people join us.
Yeah,
and turn their back away and make them run for the mountains with their trousers under their arm. That is what we have to make sure happens. You know, like, that's our only hope, Richie. Otherwise, we are going back to the era of the pharaohs and the sultans.
Can I ask another question on that? First of all, let me apologize for asking the question about the Bible, simply because I asked a similar question.
No,
it's repetition. It's repetition. Last time you were on, I asked a similar question.
You know, it's a legitimate question. And I mean, it's a very interesting discussion. And I'd be very happy to go into much more of that with you someday if you want.
Absolutely, anytime.
It's a much bigger area. And I have very mixed feelings about it, to be honest, Richie. I mean, I don't know if you would call it faith. I have a certainty that there is something beyond this world to which we are attached, metaphysically, put it like that.
Yeah.
And that's a profound thing. But, you know, that can actually, I suppose, manifest itself in all kinds of ways, including in Ireland, Catholicism. That's the main brand, as it were, or franchise. And that's the way I kind of see it, even though that sounds, again, a little bit, I suppose, irreverent.
No, it's a brilliant answer. I respect you for it, because I'm coming to feel like you feel, having kind of been an atheist for... I'm not into identity politics. I've never really believed in the benevolent creator. However, I'm with you now that there is something, and it's maybe benevolent, maybe.
Well, Richie, we have to have that discussion then, because I can tell you, you'll be amazed if you start to think about it in certain ways, which I think I can help people to think about it in certain ways. I did an interview in the last week with a priest from the west of Ireland, and it should be going up on YouTube before too long. A man called the name of Brendan Kilcoyne, a very nice man, very bright man. And I actually got to a lot of this stuff. It's very interesting, because I think that the big problem that people have with understanding is that they're blocked by not so much the question of God or whatever that means, but they're blocked by the edifices that man himself has built, which make it appear that, well, we have the world, we've made the world, and we don't need this God thing. It's a complicated thing, but I think it's a very interesting thing, because I think people need to be liberated from this, a lot of this kind of, I would call it pseudo-atheistic kind of stuff, because it's actually, it's just a blank denial. And usually, it's actually, I'm not saying in your case or anything, but it's like a lot of people that I meet that tell me that are atheists, they're not really atheists. They just don't like God.
They just, that's a very good point. By the way, because I have one more question to ask you, and we've really then only got about 5 minutes for you to answer it, but it's important. It's about the, you know, the masses coming together, because I've got an interesting question for you. The interview with Father Brendan, so this is on, or it will be on YouTube. So we just need to look for John Waters on YouTube, do we? I've seen the YouTube channel before.
It's actually called the Brendan Option is the site. And I don't know when it's going up, but I hope it won't be too long now, like a week or two maybe, hopefully. And it's a very long interview, but I think they're putting it up in certain sections. And there's some very interesting, I think, explorations between the two of us.
No doubt. Well, brilliant. Well, first of all, before I ask you the final question, go to johnwaters.substack.com, people. Please bookmark the site so that you can check in with John regularly. Jean Ann tells me that it's a brilliant and detailed tribute to Bob Dylan, who turned 80 this week. I haven't read that yet, but I am going to read it, because I am a recent, well, last 5 years convert to Dylan's music. I've been collecting his vinyl albums, love them, Blonde on Blonde. Never listened to any of this stuff when I was, you know, in my teens or in my 20s. But here's my final question. You talked about people coming together. Look, several hundred thousand people, that's an enormous number, have marched in London, and I applaud them. I think it's lovely. However, the thing that annoys me is that they march to the tune of mounted policemen and women. They do what they're told. Now, it's nice, they meet one another, and they all know that this is a load of bollocks, which is good, so they get a kind of a spiritual kick from it. My question is, that is enough people to basically gently and very peaceably, never use violence, go to Downing Street or go to Westminster and tell them all to fuck right off. Why doesn't that happen? 5 minutes now.
Because it's controlled. I mean, that's the problem. You know, that people still will go back. This is the puzzle of the line between peace and violence, you know. And this has been an issue with right throughout history, that ultimately, you know, men are driven to the sword or the gun. And that's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, it should be avoidable. But you see, these people will not, if people will not listen to reason, if they will not allow people to speak, then people will then say, well, the words won't work. We can't, you know, we can only do so much by swearing at them. And at a certain point say, well, okay, we leave it now to the other kind of guy, the guy who actually doesn't talk too much. And he's coming, you see, Richie, behind all this. We don't know it, but I've had hints of it in the last few months. You know, they're out there. There are men out there who are going to, you know, take a different tack with all this. It's not my way. And I'm no good at it. And as I say, I'll be 66 in a couple of days. So I'm off the hook, as it were, with the shooting and all the rest of it. But I can see that happening within a couple of years if these people do not come to their senses and stop this. And not alone stop it, but actually step down, confess their sins, confess that they have erred beyond belief, that they have sinned against the very freedom of the people, that they are shameful people, that they are ashamed of themselves, and that they are going to crawl away now into their burrows and stay there for the rest of their life, something like that. And that then the stage will be left again for people to put right this, to ensure that the judges who sat by, the judges who screwed Simon Dolan in his case in London, who refused to hear his case, that those guys step down, they leave, that the politicians are responsible, everybody leaves that is responsible for this, and that we have some chance then of rebooting our civilization.
Yeah.
Short of that, I don't see a way. I mean, it is absolutely a joke to hear these people slagging off Lukashenko. Like, I mean, it is, you know, he's a complete bollocks, of course, but so are they.
Absolutely.
In fact, they're worse, because he's not a hypocrite.
No, it's warts and all with him, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, and he is a tough bastard, and you know, he, and in particular, but for example, in relation, I mean, his greatest areas of criminality, I think, have been in relation to the journalistic profession, and there they do appear to have good journalists in Belarus, really brave, dedicated people. They didn't need to do that here, you know, in our countries, because all they had to do was buy them off.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. And they still call themselves journalists, but they're actually propagandists, you know? And so that's all saying, what was that sign, Humbert Wolf, his famous saying about, you cannot hope to bribe or twist, thank God, the English, well, the British journalist, well, you could say the Irish journalist. But seeing what that man will do unbribed, there's no occasion to. And that's, you know, but they have bribed them now. And they have shamed the profession that I worked in for 40 years. I couldn't possibly, you know, I keep telling everybody, I've told my wife like that if ever there's an obituary when I die and it mentions the word journalist, she's to demand a correction and clarification the following day. Say, no, no, my husband stopped being a journalist many years ago. He was ashamed of the years he spent as a journalist. He regards it as a shameful profession. I don't know what I call myself now. I like the word newspaper man. I used to be a newspaper man.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a decent thing to be. Yeah. You know, it's not now. It's a disgusting thing to be now, Richie. You know, it really is.
Do me a favour. A couple of things I'd love to get into with you in the future. One is looking at, you talked there about the men with the guns. You know as well as I do that the vast majority of people, they fear that. They fear an overthrow of the establishment, even if the establishment is tyrannical and wretched and awful, because they fear the replacement. Yeah. That's worth exploring that next time you're on. And certainly the esoteric.
And we've had a terrible record in recent times, Richie, as you know, We all know in that particular area. The worm of violence is a very dark thing. You know, and we have seen, you know, we could talk about that. But what I'm saying is that ultimately, if people are not allowed to speak, if people are tyrannized, if you have people like Margaret Buttermore thrown in jail for being a brave person, standing up to tyranny, then I'm afraid the day is coming when the guns will come out.
No doubt about it. JohnWaters.substack.com. John, I don't do the old soppy talk, and I'm not one for, you know, sick of fancy, I'm not. But I love that you're still writing the blog. I do, mate. I love the fact that you never say no to independent media content creators, people like myself. You're always there. You're as eloquent as anybody I've ever heard speaking on any issue. So just thanks for being yourself.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's always a pleasure. I really love to do it. And we should do that thing about, I won't say the word is faith. I actually think what is called faith is actually pure knowledge and wonder at reality. And I think that's a really interesting discussion, Mike, that there's a way of looking out the window that you kind of see that this is not, we're not alone. That's the point.
Listen,
I'd love to talk about that.
Anytime the door is wide open, we'll make that arrangement, you and me, over email. John, thanks. Great. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday and thanks for your time. It's greatly appreciated.
Thanks. Bless you. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye.
John. The lovely John Waters, the gifted John Waters, by the way, johnwaters.substack.com. Do subscribe to him, please, you know. A couple of quid, really. They don't exist, these guys. They really don't, you know. They're mostly gone. And he's still there, so thanks to him. And Tony Gosling is another one, by the way. Thanks to Tony as well for Hour One, John Waters. I'm going to go and watch some foosball now on the telly. And I'm going to regress back to my childhood when I used to get very excited when Paul McGrath and Kevin Moran and Gary Bailey and Brian Robson, my biggest football hero ever, used to play in cup finals. I'm going to pretend that I'm a kid again and watch a bit of soccer at 8 o'clock. That said, the Europa League final. Anyway, I know you probably don't care about that. I will be with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Now, also, tomorrow evening, I will be with Hayden Hewitt and Graham Booth. You need to go to youtube.com/altfeed. ALTFEED. /altfeed. Going to be on the telly with the boys tomorrow night. I'd love you to watch that because it's going to be a lot of fun. There will be a lot of giggles and God knows we need a few laughs, don't we? I'm closing out this programme with the one and only Boss and his beautiful House of a Thousand Guitars from his latest album, Letter to You. Thanks for being there. Thanks, John. Thanks, Tony. Speak tomorrow. Bye.